Ever wonder where the government draws the line when it comes to funding religious schools?
Yeah.
Today, we're diving deep into a Supreme Court case
Oh, okay.
that tackled that very question. Mitchell v. Helms.
Okay.
It's a case that still has people debating even years later.
Well, what's so interesting about this case is that it touches on a principle that's at the very core of American democracy,
Yeah.
the separation of church and state.
Right.
And as we'll see, Mitchell v. Helms really pushed the boundaries of how we interpret that separation, especially when it comes to education.
Okay, so let's set the scene. We're talking about a federal program, Chapter 2, of the Education Consolidation and Improvement Act of 1981.
Right.
Sounds pretty dry, but essentially, it gave money to states and local education agencies so they could provide educational materials and equipment to both public and private schools.
The catch, of course, is that about 30% of those private schools were religiously affiliated, mostly Catholic, in this particular case, in Jefferson Parish, Louisiana.
Yeah.
And that's where things get tricky.
Right, because some people felt that this program was essentially the government putting its stamp of approval on religion.
Exactly. A group of Jefferson Parish residents filed a lawsuit arguing that this funding violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. Now, just to clarify for our listeners, the Establishment Clause is the part of the Constitution that says the government can't establish or favor any one religion.
Ah, so that's where the whole separation of church and state idea comes from.
Precisely. And this case had a long and winding road to the Supreme Court. Lower courts went back and forth, declaring the program unconstitutional, then unconstitutional again. Talk about a legal roller coaster.
Wow, so it was a real nail biter.
Yeah.
So when the case finally reached the Supreme Court, what were the main legal issues they had to grapple with?
Well, a big part of the debate centered around the Lemon Test. It's a three-part test the Supreme Court uses to determine whether a government action violates the Establishment Clause. First, it asks, does the action have a secular purpose? Second, does its primary effect advance or inhibit religion? And finally, does it create excessive government entanglement with religion?
Okay, I see. So the court had to figure out if this funding program passed the Lemon Test. But didn't they already deal with similar questions in a previous case?
You're thinking of Agostini v. Felton, right?
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. That case actually modified the Lemon Test a bit.
Okay.
So the key question in Mitchell v. Helms wasn't just about whether the program had a secular purpose or caused entanglement, but whether this neutral, indirect aid to religious schools could be seen as the government endorsing religion. It gets pretty nuanced.
It sounds like it. And I bet the Supreme Court's decision was a real game changer.
You bet. It was a 6-3 decision in favor of the program, which means a majority of the justices felt that funding religious schools in this way was constitutional. But even within that majority, there were some interesting differences in their reasoning.
Wait, so they all agreed on the outcome, but not necessarily why it was okay.
Yeah.
Now that's intriguing. Tell me more about those different viewpoints.
All right, let's start with Justice Thomas, who wrote the plurality opinion. He essentially argued that as long as the funding is neutral and parents get to choose where their kids go to school, it's all good. He felt that the government shouldn't be in the business of deciding how religious a school is.
So parent choice was a major factor in his thinking. What about the other justices? Did any of them have reservations?
Justice O'Connor agreed with the outcome, but offered a word of caution. She emphasized that just because you have neutral criteria for handing out money, it doesn't mean there can't be any misuse. She was basically saying, let's keep a watchful eye on things.
Makes sense. I can see how some people might worry about those funds being used for things that go beyond the secular purpose of the program.
Right. And that's precisely what the dissenting justices were concerned about. Justice Souter, who wrote the main dissent, argued quite passionately that this kind of funding essentially subsidizes religious activities, which, in his view, crosses the line between church and state.
So we have a plurality opinion emphasizing neutrality and parent choice, a concurring opinion urging caution, and a dissenting opinion raising red flags about blurring the lines. This case really is shaping up to be a fascinating legal tug of war. But can you give us some specific examples from the case to illustrate this tension between neutrality and potential misuse, something our listeners can really sink their teeth into?
Well, imagine a school gets funding for computers through this program. Seems pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah.
Computers for education, everyone wins. But what if the school decides to use those computers for religious instruction after school hours?
Ah, I see where you're going with this. On the surface, the funding is neutral computers are computers, but how they're used could blur those lines between secular and religious activities.
Exactly. And that was a big point of contention in this case. Justice Thomas, writing for the plurality, argued that as long as the aid itself is neutral, how it's ultimately used by the school isn't the government's concern. A microscope is a microscope, whether it's in a public school or a religious school.
But Justice Souter would probably counter that even seemingly neutral resources can free up other school funds to support religious activities, right? It becomes a bit of a shell game.
Precisely. He argued that religious schools often integrate their faith into every aspect of the curriculum, so even something as simple as providing textbooks could indirectly support their religious mission. He worried that the government was, in effect, subsidizing religious education.
So it becomes a question of where you draw the line. If the government provides funding for textbooks that teach evolution, but the school also uses those funds to buy textbooks that teach creationism, is that okay?
That's a tough one, and the Mitchell v. Helms decision didn't really give us a clear-cut answer. It sparked more questions than it answered, which is why it's been cited in so many subsequent cases about school funding.
So this case didn't settle the debate. It actually opened up a whole new can of worms.
It did. And that's one of the things that makes Mitchell v. Helms so significant. It didn't just decide the fate of one particular federal program. It fundamentally changed the way we think about the relationship between government and religion, particularly in the context of education. And it has had some real-world implications.
You're right. This isn't just an abstract legal argument.
Oh, yeah.
So how has Mitchell v. Helms played out in the realm of education policy?
Well, for one thing, it's had a major impact on the debate over school vouchers. Some states have implemented programs that allow parents to use public funds to send their children to private schools, including religious ones.
And I'm guessing those programs have been met with legal challenges, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Opponents argue that they violate the Establishment Clause because they funnel public money towards institutions that promote a particular faith. They point to Mitchell v. Helms as setting a dangerous precedent.
It sounds like we're walking a tightrope here.
Yeah.
On the one hand, you have the argument for school choice and giving parents more options. On the other, you have the concern about public funds being used to support religious indoctrination.
Exactly. And the legal landscape is constantly evolving. It's worth noting that the current Supreme Court seems to be even more open to the idea of government support for religious institutions than the court that decided Mitchell v. Helms.
So this debate is far from over. If anything, it's become even more heated in recent years.
You could say that again. As the lines between church and state continue to blur, the question of where to draw the line becomes even more critical.
This brings us to another interesting point. Mitchell v. Helms primarily dealt with funding for educational materials, but it's been used to justify other types of funding as well, hasn't it?
It has. Some states have cited this case as a basis for providing funding to religious schools for things like technology upgrades, transportation, even security measures.
It sounds like this case has really opened the floodgates for more government money to flow to religious institutions.
That's one interpretation. But supporters of these policies argue that they're simply creating a level playing field, ensuring that all students have access to the same opportunities, regardless of where they go to school. They say that as long as the funding is neutral and available to all schools, public or private, religious or secular, there's no constitutional violation.
But the other side would argue that even if the funding appears neutral on paper, the reality is that it can be used to support religious activities, which they see as a step too far.
That's the crux of the debate, and Mitchell v. Helms didn't give us any easy answers.
So as legal experts, what do you think is the most important takeaway from this case for lawyers and law students who are trying to navigate this complex landscape?
I think the key takeaway is that the courts are becoming increasingly willing to allow government support for religious institutions, particularly in the context of education. Mitchell v. Helms was a pivotal moment in this trend, and we're still seeing its effects today.
So it's not just a historical curiosity. It's a living legal precedent that continues to shape the way we think about these issues.
Absolutely. And it highlights the importance of understanding the nuances of the Establishment Clause and the various tests that courts have developed to interpret it.
For anyone working on cases related to education policy, this case is essential reading.
I'd agree with that. And it's a reminder that the law is not static. It's constantly evolving in response to new challenges and societal shifts.
Well said. So we've covered the background of the case, the legal arguments, the Supreme Court's decision, and even some of the broader implications for education policy. But there's still so much more to unpack here.
There is. We've been focusing on the legal aspects, but this case also raises a lot of deeper philosophical and societal questions about the role of religion in public life. Questions that are as relevant today as they were back in 2000 when the Supreme Court issued its decision.
It sounds like we've reached another natural point to pause and reflect. But don't go anywhere, folks, because in part three, we'll delve into some of those broader implications and explore what Mitchell v. Helms means for the future of education in America. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. We've been unpacking this landmark case, Mitchell v. Helms, and exploring the legal ins and outs of government funding for religious schools. But now let's shift gears a bit and think about the bigger picture. What are the philosophical and societal ripples of this decision?
This case really forces us to confront some fundamental questions about the role of religion in public life. On one hand, there's the argument that excluding religious institutions from public benefits is a form of discrimination. If the goal is to ensure that all children have access to quality education, shouldn't religious schools be included in that effort?
Right, it's about fairness and equal opportunity. But then there's the other side of the coin, the concern that public funds flowing to institutions that promote a particular faith could erode the separation of church and state.
Exactly. Critics worry about a slippery slope. If the government can fund textbooks for religious schools, what's to stop them from funding religious instruction itself? Where do you draw the line? It's a question that has no easy answers.
It really highlights the tension between individual choice and collective good, doesn't it?
Mm.
If parents have the right to choose a religious education for their children, does that mean the government is obligated to support that choice financially?
It does, and it gets even more complicated when you consider the diversity of religious beliefs in our society. What happens when different religious groups have different expectations for education? Can the government remain neutral in those situations?
So Mitchell v. Helms didn't just raise legal questions. It opened up a Pandora's box of societal and philosophical dilemmas. It's like the case that keeps on giving, even decades later.
It is, and it's fascinating to see how this case has become a touchstone in so many contemporary debates, from school choice and vouchers to charter schools and even homeschooling.
It seems like Mitchell v. Helms keeps popping up whenever there's a discussion about the intersection of education, religion, and public funding.
It does, and it forces us to ask ourselves some tough questions. What do we prioritize as a society? Individual choice or the separation of church and state? How do we balance the rights of religious groups with the need for a neutral public sphere?
These are questions that every democracy grapples with, and there are no easy answers. What might seem like a perfectly neutral policy to one person could feel like a violation of their deeply held beliefs to another.
It's a minefield. And it requires us to engage in thoughtful and respectful dialogue even when we disagree. We need to listen to each other, understand different perspectives, and try to find some common ground.
That's a great point. At the end of the day, we're all part of the same society, and we need to find ways to navigate these complex issues together.
Absolutely. And I think Mitchell v. Helms, for all its complexities and controversies, provides a valuable framework for having those conversations.
So let's zoom out one last time. We started by looking at a specific case about funding for educational materials. But through this deep dive, we've explored broader questions about religious freedom, the role of government, and the very nature of American democracy.
And perhaps the most important takeaway is that these aren't just abstract legal debates. They have real-world implications for how we educate our children and shape the future of our society.
Well said. Mitchell v. Helms may have been decided over two decades ago, but its legacy lives on. It's a case that continues to challenge us, provoke us, and remind us of the enduring tension between individual liberty and the common good.
And on that note, we'll leave you with this thought. If Mitchell v. Helms opened a door to greater interaction between government and religion in the context of education, what are the limits of that interaction? Where do you think that line should be drawn? It's a question worth pondering.
Food for thought, folks. Until next time, keep diving deep.